Hello, Eitan.
Hello, Naor.
What is up?
I'm good.
Well,
I'm really
well,
good.
When we aired this, it's already 2017. You know, we can start recounting this year's
dead celebrities.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
the counter has just zeroed.
2016. I wonder if 2017 is going to try and outdo 2016. You know, and just take like a nuke's going to drop in Hollywood. It's going to be like, "Huh? 2016, how do you feel about that?"
Right.
You thought you were bad? This is me. Just take out all of Hollywood.
Well, in the meantime, we're here. We're two nice Jewish boys. We're a podcast.
Yeah.
Which means that every week we host a guest from Israel, an interesting persona.
Persona?
Who comes here to talk to us.
Yeah.
God knows why, but they come.
Yeah, somehow. We pay them.
No.
Millions
of likes.
Hopefully. That's up to you guys.
So we're a podcast about Israel, and you're invited to follow us. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. We have a website. Eitan, give them our website, please.
www.2njb.com.
Thank you, Hillbilly Eitan. So that's a website, and we're on iTunes. And the podcast app on Apple, just search Two Nice Jewish Boys and subscribe. And if you have an Android, just download the app like Podcast Addict, download it and add us there. It's pretty easy, self-explanatory, and enjoy and listen and share. So this is a very special episode for us because Eitan and I had the honor of meeting Professor Israel Aumann, the Nobel Prize laureate for his work on game theory.
Yes.
How was it for a simpleton like yourself?
I mean, I never thought
such a
never thought I'd
big man.
I'd meet a Nobel Prize winner when I was growing up in the country, but I gotta say he was pretty darn smart, and it was definitely an honor.
Yes.
It was amazing. I think when I realized who the man was when he got up to look for that quote. We were in the middle of the interview, and he got up for 3 minutes because a quote had popped into his head.
And he wanted to be accurate,
and he wanted to give us the quote. Yeah. So for 3 or 4 minutes, and then I remembered what it is. I mean, my father's a mathematician, so I remembered, you know, what academics are like all of a sudden. I got a flash of it, and it was like he got up. 3 minutes, we were pretty much quiet. I was eating my Hanukkah donut. You were munching on strawberries. And he just started looking through his papers
until
he found it.
Yeah, so it was a very exciting. For me, the most exciting part was the opportunity we've had to glimpse on his whiteboard or blackboard and see the quotes that he wrote for himself, the quotes that inspire him. We talk about it in the episode. So it felt like looking into history, in a sense. You know, who didn't want to look at Obama's whiteboard or John Nash or whomever? And we got to see that.
To get
a glimpse. So it was pretty exciting. So we invite you to listen to the episode and enjoy. And follow us on the channels that we've mentioned. And if you like this episode, please share it. Do a mitzvah. It would make Eitan so happy.
So happy.
And so it'll jolly. Help us start
in the Christmas spirit,
the
holiday spirit.
Yeah. So, thank you and enjoy.
Thank you, guys.
Live from Tel Aviv, two nice Jewish boys, Eitan Weinstein and Naor Mininger.
Hello, Eitan.
Hello, Naor.
How are you?
I'm doing good.
I'm excited.
Why are you excited?
Because we're sitting here with Professor Israel Aumann.
That's true. Today we are joined by Dr. Israel Aumann, who is a mathematician, an economist, and a game theorist. He's a professor at the Center for the Study of Rationality at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, where we are right now. He received the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2005 for his work on conflict and cooperation through game theory analysis. And
Chag Sameach, Professor.
Chag Sameach, first of all. How are you?
Chag Sameach, Chag Sameach.
Do you have a favorite game?
I like chess. I don't play it very well, but it's a good game. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you find that you can apply the theories to chess?
There is something that you can apply to chess. Game theory applies to chess, and what it says is this. It says something which is not entirely obvious, and it is this. Either white can force a win, or black can force a win, or both sides can force at least a draw. Now, that may sound stupid to you, yes, trivial, but if you listened carefully, it's not the same thing as saying either black wins or white wins or the outcome is a draw. That's not what I said. I said either white can force a win or black can force a win or both sides can force a draw. And that's something different, and it's not so obvious.
How is it different?
Well, take the game scissors, paper, stone. You've heard of that game?
Yep. Okay. Lost many times in the game.
And there, it's not true what I said. Yes, that either, let's say, Abe is playing with Bob, okay? Or Abe is playing with Barbara, to be politically correct. Yes, and it's not true that either Abe can force a win or Barbara can force a win or both sides can force at least a draw. No matter what Abe does, that's Barbara chance. Could win, yeah. Yes. No matter what Barbara does, Abe could win. Neither side can force anything. Yes.
Yeah.
So, but in chess, it's not that way. In chess, the outcome is, in fact, that in other words, chess is a determined game. The only thing is, we don't know what the answer is.
Uh-huh.
But it is a determined game. Chess is different from many other games in that respect, or even a simple game like matching pennies, okay, or choosing up sides. If I'm supposed to match your penny, so if it's both heads or both tails, then I win, and if it's opposite, then you win. Neither side can force a win. Neither side. Because if I play heads, you could play tails. Mm-hmm. And if you play heads, then I could play heads, yes? There's no way in which any side can force a win. But in chess, it's not that way. The only thing about chess is that nobody knows how to do it, okay?
Yes.
Yes? But there are games, there are interesting games in which, in fact, we can apply the same reasoning that applies to chess and show that one of the two sides, and we know which one it is, can force a win, but we don't know how. Okay, so that's
why it's the most popular game of all of that family, because it has that aspect.
Many games of that kind, like Go, okay, mm-hmm. or checkers, or most board games, yes, not including what's it called, the backgammon,
mm-hmm.
not including backgammon. Most board games have that property mm-hmm. that, in principle, they're determined. In principle,
mm-hmm.
the only thing is we don't know how to do it.
Right.
Actually, checkers, we do know how to do it. All right.
Mm-hmm.
I think I don't remember which it is, but I think in checkers the first player wins. The player to move first wins, and we in fact know how to do it. Okay. Uh-huh. But that has been that's a development of the last 30 or 40 years. Okay.
That we know.
Yes. That we know. It was known for 70 or 80 years already that one of the three possibilities holds. But which one was not known, and how to do it has only became known recently. Mm-hmm. But checkers is a relatively simple game. Mm-hmm. Chess is much more complex and interesting. And
you researched it?
What?
Did you research it?
No, this is something that I, so that you know, it's a background. I researched other things, but yes. not that.
So no, what yeah. I'm trying to understand, but so what you're saying is that there technically chess is a game, that there is a way to know exactly how to move and you can win it 100% of the times. We just don't know how
that's
to.
Right. Yeah, that's right. One of the three possibilities. We don't know which one in chess, okay? We don't know whether black forces a win or white forces a win or both sides can force a draw.
Okay.
We don't know which one of the three possibilities, okay. But one of those possibilities holds.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So you've been asked many times, but just to get it off the table, what is game theory and how did you encounter it? How did you get involved with it?
Okay, there are two questions here. What is game theory is question number one. And the answer is that it is an analysis of situations in which several parties are involved, several entities, and each one is striving to maximize the good for himself. Each side is trying to do as well as possible for himself, recognizing that the other sides are doing the same. And very often the sides are what's good for me is not necessarily good for you. It may be, it may not be. We may be opposite, like in chess. So
it's a zero-sum game.
It's a zero-sum game. But most interesting games are not zero-sum, okay? Most interesting games are, there's some element of cooperation is desirable and some element of competition. So most games are fixed. There are also games which are, we call them games of coordination, where what's good for me is also good for you. Mm-hmm. But that, again, is most games are not like that. Mm-hmm. Most games have a mix of cooperation is desirable and competition. And each side competes with the other.
And how did you encounter it?
How did I encounter it? Well, I did a doctorate in mathematics. In fact, in pure mathematics. And over there, I spent about 4 or 5 years doing the doctorate. In the fourth year, I think, John Nash, who was the hero of what's the
Beautiful
name?
Mind.
A Beautiful Mind, that's right. He had finished a doctorate at Princeton, just finished a doctorate. I was at MIT. And I was a senior graduate student, and he came to MIT as an instructor, so he was sort of on the lowest rank of postdoctoral work, and I was on the senior doctoral student. We got to know each other, and he explained to me what his work on game theory had been about. And I was in pure mathematics, and I listened, and I understood what he said, but it didn't really grab me. Mm-hmm. So,
from a pure mathematical standpoint, it seems almost like abstract a bit.
No? On the contrary, it seems very concrete, and pure mathematicians don't like the concrete. They like
really?
The abstract, uh-huh. Yes. But okay. In fact, my...
We're film students. We know nothing. We don't know... We don't even know that.
Long division.
My dear, people are forgetting the multiplication table because they just take out to their telephones to multiply 3 by 2.
Or smarter phones.
So they're forgetting the... So if you don't know the multiplication table,
get out
you're
here.
Like a lot of people, yes. No, I, in fact, was in an area of pure mathematics that that is quite concrete. It's called knot theory. The theory of knots, not... when I say knot theory, you could think it's practice, but I'm not theory.
Yeah.
But no, that's it. It's K-N-O-T.
Okay? Oh, right.
The, knot, the theory of knots. Okay. And that
meaning?
Is...
meaning?
Well, the mathematical analysis of knots... here, there's one on the blackboard. Here, I have some more I could show you, but it's not going to go over on the radio, right? So, a knot is what you tie in a rope.
Yeah, the knot that I imagine, that's what you research. The knot
what,
that...
what you tie in a rope, and those things, and not each, we are, knots can be different from each other, or can be similar to each other, and the whole study, the analysis of that, it's quite concrete. Sounding, yes, and it is, but it's deep mathematics, and it's very much related to pure, it is pure mathematics, or at least at the time I thought it was very, very pure mathematics.
So here comes John Nash, steps into your
John Nash comes, and we talk about game theory, because he did his thesis in game theory. And we talk about that, and I think, okay, it's very nice, it's interesting. We banter it about back and forth, but it doesn't really grab me. And then after my doctorate, I went to work for an operations research firm. You guys know what operations research is?
In intelligence.
It's
Army related?
It's intelligence, but it's all kinds of things that have to do with how do you say nihul in English?
Management.
Management, that's right. All kinds of management problems.
Okay.
Logistics. I think that's the best. That's what covers it best. The word logistics covers operations research. It's the application of mathematics to solve logistic management problems and so on. And for example, assigning people to jobs. Okay, that's one example in an optimal way. In this outfit, we got a problem from Bell Telephone Laboratories, who were developing a ground-to-air missile. This was the middle of the 50s, so it was the height of the Cold War. Maybe not quite the height, but we were working up to the height of the Cold War. I think the height of the Cold War came in the 60s. Anyway, they were developing a ground-to-air missile, and the problem that they were that they gave us, this outfit that I was working for, is suppose you have an attack by a squadron of aircraft, which most of which are demis, they're not carrying any weapons, and some of which, a relatively small number, are carrying nuclear bombs. Now you have this ground-to-air missile, what are you going to do with it? Yes, how are you going to... How are you going to try to identify the ones that are carrying bombs? Or what will you try to do about it? How can you best attack this problem? Not only attack the aircraft, but attack the problem, okay? The assignment was given to me to work on. And
without you being into game theory.
Without my being into game theory. But then... You know, once the boss gave me this assignment, saying, okay, Bob, you work on this, I realized, I remembered the conversations with Nash, and I realized that this is game theory, and that's the way you have
to... How is this game theory? How do you
tackle...
Well,
when you're playing a game, you're a squadron of aircraft how will they distribute their bombs and so on, and are they going to cluster them together, keep them apart and so on, and they want to not to be shot down, or they want at least those planes carrying bombs. They shouldn't shoot them down. And we, okay, the ground-to-air missile, you want to, this is a classical, and this is, in a sense, this is almost a zero-sum game, although maybe it's not quite a zero-sum game either, because it's best for everybody if nobody gets shot down and nobody drops any bombs. Yes,
we're
so
all
it's not
off.
Quite. We're all better off. So it's not quite a zero sum game, but in some way you can think of it as a zero sum game. So I remembered the conversations with Nash, and I started reading up on game theory and attacking this problem. And then after that, it did grab me, okay? So after I got my hands dirty with it,
you saw the potential.
And I don't know whether I saw potential. It just grabbed me. I don't think there was any potential in my head at that moment, yes? It just grabbed me for the intellectual challenge, the intellectual interest, and one thing led to another, and here we are.
So it was curiosity.
Yeah. Curiosity, yeah. challenge, I would say. Yeah. A mixture of curiosity and challenge, yes.
Okay. So let's, I want to take a step back, because I know now we're in Israel, we're here in Jerusalem. You were born in Germany, correct?
I was born in Frankfurt in 1930, yes.
In 1930.
30.
And then you moved to the States at some point.
1938. That's
1938,
correct.
Right before the beginning of World War II.
More than a year before. We on Tisha B'Av 1938, we left Frankfurt and moved to the United States.
So you got to live 5 years into the Nazi regime. Under
eight
the Nazi
years, 8 years. 8 years.
8 years, but 33, so okay.
Nazi that's
regime.
That's right.
An age that you remember. You already remember things. So, what do you remember from that period? How was the life?
Well, the thing, once in a while we would get beaten up on the way to school, but I think what stands out in my mind more clearly is the signs on the windows and the doors of the shops. Which they were with a light brown background and black lettering, which was had a font which was meant to imitate Hebrew, okay? Mm-hmm. But it was ordinary German letters, but meant to imitate Hebrew. And what it said was, Juden sind hier unerwünscht, which means Jews are unwanted here. We don't want Jews in this shop. And that sort of made an impression on me. One saw that pretty often. This is, I mean, if you're asking about, what is the most vivid memory of those times, it's that. Now I'll tell you another story, and it's very interesting. The Anschluss was in the spring of 38. The Anschluss is the annexation of Austria to Germany. And this happened just...
No Geneva Conventions back then.
Well, this was a willing annexation.
Yeah.
The Austrians were only too happy in some ways.
Right, sorry.
Germany annexed Austria, and then there was a plebiscite, Mishal Am, the next day, to asking the people whether they approve, the German people, whether they approve of this annexation. And, of course, the thing to do was to say yes, okay. Now, the rabbi of the Frankfurt community voted no, okay. And he was arrested for voting no. So you could ask... how did they know that he voted no? Yes. Well, they knew. Okay, don't ask. Yes. And why was he arrested? Well, he was arrested. Don't ask. Okay.
Not too many questions.
That was the German democracy. Okay.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about this is that my brother, who was going on 12, not quite 12 yet, 11 and a half, and I, we were very, very good friends, very close to each other, only two children in the family, and we discussed everything. And here you guys are two nice Jewish boys, okay? But we were also two nice Jewish boys. And these two nice Jewish boys in Germany in 1938, with all the harassment and all the persecution and all the discrimination, we said the Germans were right to arrest him. Yes, he had it coming to him. Why? Because he was stupid to vote no? No, because it was morally wrong to vote no. Yes, the Germans, one should vote yes. And these are two nice Jewish boys, yes, were so overwhelmed with the atmosphere at that time that we actually thought the rabbi had done something wrong, okay?
The amazing power of Nazi propaganda.
Yeah, we were overpowered by the... I don't know whether you would call it direct propaganda, but...
The ambience.
The ambience, that's the word. The ambience.
And in your home, your parents, how did they feel about this?
No, of course not. No.
So you
My parents were a nice Jewish man and a nice Jewish woman. No. No, we got this from the outside. No,
right.
Okay, no.
So
it's terrifying. Yeah. It's fascinating and terrifying at the same time.
Yeah. It's hard to imagine, you know, for us.
Yes.
Living on that point for us, it's almost like a legend, that period. It's so it's hard to imagine those times. I don't know how to describe it. But back to your work, Professor Aumann, you talk a lot about rationality, and you also deal with war and politics. And I was wondering, because I heard your lectures, and you often say that war is not irrational.
Oh, of course not.
So why is that?
Well, when you look at it from the individual point of view, it's not irrational, because people feel threatened, okay? Nations feel threatened, and they feel if they would not go to war, they would be overrun. They would get their throat slit, yes. Abraham Lincoln, on the eve of the Civil War, he said in one of the greatest speeches of all time, Lincoln's second inaugural, which I think is much more profound than the Gettysburg Address, for example. It's, as I say, one of the greatest speeches of all time. Lincoln said, both parties deprecated war, but one would make war rather than let the nation survive, and the other would accept war rather than let it perish, and the war came. Each side, because of the actions of the other side, it was rational for each side to make war.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So war, the point is that when looked at from the standpoint of an overarching standpoint that includes all the players, yes, from that standpoint, war is not rational. But when you look at each one separately, and that's what game theory does, that's what game theory is all about. It's looking at each of the players separately in the context of the whole game. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes rational for each side to make war, because he is, in a sense, forced into it by the circumstances of what the other side is doing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the other option, the more desirable option is to make peace, hopefully. But I mean, I'm reading here on your board, you have a quote from an unexpected source. Yeah, but the belief that peace is desirable is rarely enough to achieve it.
That's right.
What's the source?
That's Barack Obama.
Oh, right.
Barack Obama in his Nobel Peace Prize lecture, yes. So what Obama was saying actually is, my dear audience, yes, it's not that simple. It's you gave me this Nobel Prize because I want peace. Okay, but that's not enough. Okay, it's not enough to want peace. That's the point. It's not enough to want peace. To get peace is not enough, all right? And that is where the Peace Now people are making a big mistake, okay? The Peace Now people, they want peace now, okay? But that actually wanting peace now is going to make it harder to get it now or in the future, okay?
Right.
So, and Obama realized that, and maybe if people would listen to him, then this particular insight, actually Obama, as you probably know, throughout his entire administration, 8 years, America was at war. It's the longest period that America has been at war in history, okay? So this president who got the Peace Prize in 2009, yes, actually was a not the world champion, but the American champion of war. Champion not in the sense of being for it, but in the sense of doing it, yes.
What do you mean? You mean the war in Iraq and his involvement in Syria?
In Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria, all over the Middle East.
And yet
he's never
world...
out of it. He's never out. He's not out of it now. Yeah.
Yeah. And yet the world is even more, has drawn more into war than when he got this Nobel Prize, which is ironic, I'd say.
Well, I mean, there was a lot of criticism of the Nobel Prize at that time. I mean, people were just taken, I think, with the, in a way, a beautiful idea, a black president, and, you know, a lot of nice rhetoric. But he himself realized that the rhetoric is not enough.
Yeah.
He himself, he is... No, I think like most presidents of the United States, he is an unusual person and very gifted, and there's no question about it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it seems to me the issue, as relates to game theory, is that the Peace Now people are ignoring the fact that there's another player, and that that other player wants something that's.
yes, I think that's putting it very succinctly.
You have a future, Eitan, being a game theorist.
A game theorist summarizer.
Let's a little less succinctly. They don't realize that by sending these signals of suing for peace, yes, they are actually prolonging the war.
Hmm.
Okay, prolonging the standoff.
You're saying if you want peace, prepare for war.
Oh, that's exactly right, and it's written on the blackboard there also.
Oh, okay. But where
it's written on the blackboard.
Civis pacem para bellum.
That's it. Yes, pacem. Yes, pacem.
Pacem.
Pacem. It's Latin, and the Romans, from whom I took this, they were the world champions at peace. Okay.
By forcing it in a violent way upon the weak.
Okay. Well, but they were prepared for war, and when they stopped being prepared for war, they disintegrated.
But you know, I heard you making this point. You were in a lecture in Tel Aviv University two weeks ago, and you made. But what I don't get is because Israel did prove that we're willing to fight. We proved it several times, and we fought. Like we fought like very harshly, and yet peace didn't come. I mean, I think we did prove the point that we are willing to fight and to die, but peace didn't arrive.
Well,
how do you explain that?
Because we're waffling all the time. Yes, we're waffling. We're not saying that really we have a right to this land. Without it's possible to say. We have a right to this land. This is our homeland. It's by it's it was our homeland thousands of years ago, and it is our homeland now also. And we have international guarantees. We have the San Remo Conference and the League of Nations and all that, and the Jewish Homeland, the Balfour Declaration. All this, we have a lot of legal stuff to back us up, and Palestine was, until 1948, was Palestine, okay? So it was for Jews and for Arabs, for both. There was only a short period, and this was all of Palestine, yes, including Judea and Samaria and Gaza. This was all of Palestine. And a short, relatively short period of 19 years, Jews were not allowed in Judea and Samaria, and in the heart of Jerusalem also, they were not allowed. Mm-hmm. Jews were not allowed. Not, you know, you're two nice Jewish boys. I don't know whether if you're Israeli or American or what you are, but even if you're American, if you had lived at that time, you would not be allowed to go and visit Jerusalem.
We wouldn't be sitting here.
What?
We wouldn't be sitting here.
We wouldn't be allowed to sit here and on the...
No, no, no. Here you would be allowed to sit.
Oh, okay.
No, here you would be, because this was Western Jerusalem, which was in Israeli hands. Mm-hmm. During, here you would be allowed to sit. You would not be allowed to visit the Western Wall. Mm-hmm. You would not be allowed in the Old City. And... even as Americans, because it was not enough to be an American or not to be Israeli, yes, not enough. It's not Israelis they were keeping out. They were keeping out Jews, okay?
Yes.
Judenrein, yes, free of Jews, okay? Jordan was at that time. I went in that period, I had an American passport. And I went, I did not have an Israeli passport yet, so I was a pure American, okay? And I went in that period to the American, to the Jordanian consulate in Washington and asked for a visa to Jordan because I wanted to visit the Kotel. And they said, certainly, Mr. Alman, we'll be delighted. Just bring a church membership certificate, okay? Well, a letter from your pastor. Yes?
No problem.
Yes.
No problem.
No problem, yes. So it was Jews they were keeping out, and that's what they want to do again. Yeah, they want to keep out Jews. The moment you signal to them weakness, you waffle, you say this land doesn't really, but we don't really belong here. It's only for security purposes. We don't really have any business here. The Israeli government has not yet adopted Doch Levy, yes, the Levy report. Which spells out our legal claim, our legal right to all of Palestine. Yes,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't spell out that the Arabs do not belong there, but that we do belong there also, together with the Arabs, mm-hmm. and we mm-hmm. have never been willing to say that. Yes, so I think. We have to be willing to say that, yes, and then we can take it from there, yes.
Yeah, so we very kind of smoothly, seamlessly kind of moved into politics, and it's something that we find with your theory, you know, more often than I think other theories. You know, if you're studying black holes, then I don't think it's so relevant to the Arab-Israeli conflict. But what I'm wondering is...
Well, one could call the Arab-Israeli conflict a black hole.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. The analogy's not far-fetched.
Yeah.
But I wonder, how did this come about? I mean, was it a way of looking at the political structure and then analyzing it, or did it start as a mathematical theory and develop into politics, or did it vice versa, or did it just kind of happen hand in hand
with you? That is right.
Yeah,
with you,
me,
with
yes,
you, with your personal experience with the theory.
Because you implement
it's a natural. It's a natural. I mean, economics is one of the major applications of game theory, perhaps the major application, okay? Mm-hmm. And the other one is international relations and domestic politics, okay? Mm-hmm. So those are the important areas, the most important. There's also law and other areas like that. Those are the most important areas of application of game theory, because what is game theory about? Let me remind you. As I said it 20 minutes ago, or half an hour ago, but it's about...
Two players.
It's about not two.
My
could
interest.
N players and mm-hmm. any number of players. Okay, mm-hmm. more than one. More than one. That's necessary. Okay. Mm-hmm. So
unless you're
who
insane.
Are striving to different goals? Yes.
Yes.
And are aware that they're striving to different goals, okay?
Uh-huh.
That's what it's about. They're striving to different goals, not necessarily opposite.
Right.
So in chess, it is opposite. Mm-hmm. In economics, in business, in politics, it's not opposite, but those are the natural applications. Even the way I got into game theory, there's a missile problem, missile bomber problem. This is strategic warfare, or no, it's actually tactical warfare. But from there, the step to my fellow Nobelist, the one who shared the Nobel Prize with me. I'm only half a Nobelist, by the way. Yes, not a whole one. Yes.
Right.
Tom Schelling, who just died, by the way, last week. Yes. He very much was, he was a game theorist, but he was very much into the game theory of the Cold War. And he, to a large extent, he had a big hand in this. So that's what it's about.
Apropos, if I look not to the Pax Romana times, but to the recent 100 years, we'll be right over. If I look on the recent 100 years, where do I see a good example where game theory helped strategizing between states or in a war? I mean, who did practice it well that you can point to?
That's an easy one. I mean, I can point to failures and I can point to success, but you ask for a success.
Yeah.
The success is the Cold War. The way the Cold War was run, yes, it never became hot, okay? It never became hot, and that's to a large extent because of Schelling and his friends, yes, and to some extent us also, the more theoretical types, but the more practical types. I wrote to Schelling's widow, okay, a couple of days ago, a week ago already. I wrote to his widow saying that Tom took game theory out of the ivory tower and put it into the real world, mm-hmm. okay? And that's, I think, what you can say about Schelling. We were ivory tower types. You need the ivory tower. And the Cold War, the fact that the Cold War never became hot is because... the game theorists who had...
Both sides had game theorists?
Yes.
But some would argue that
both sides had game theorists. And I used to travel to the United States frequently, and once in a while I went through Cambridge, Massachusetts, Harvard Square, and so on, and one used to see this very insistent campaign to disarm, mm-hmm. to take away the nuclear weapons, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. or even other weapons, yes. Fortunately, the United States government knew better than that, mm-hmm. because disarming would have led to war. Mm-hmm. Yeah, disarming would have led to war. Atomic weapons exist. And this is what the game theorists understand. It's not terribly deep, but it's too deep for most people, okay? it is that weapons exist in order not to use them. That's why they exist, in order not to use them. And many people in Israel don't understand that either. I was at a meeting of arm of the conference, arm of the Israeli army, I forget which it was, and somebody said, oh, we never use this, let's stop developing it. I said, no, all weapons exist in order not to use them. Yes, that's game theory. Si vis pacem, para bellum, okay? And the point is, with si vis pacem, para bellum, if you want peace, prepare for war. The point of that is that two points. One is, yes, the weapon system you have, develop them by all means to perfection, yes? And then perhaps you have a chance that you won't have to use them, okay?
Yeah.
That's what they're there for. But more than that, beyond that, you want to put it in your mind. You have to prepare for war. You have to be ready for war in your head. You have to be willing to say to the other side, you know what? I want peace. But if you want war, let's fight. Okay? Let's fight. And if you say that and mean it, then you don't have to fight. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. That's game theory. Okay?
Unless the other one says it and means it as well. Unless the other one says it and means it as well, then you will end up fighting.
No, if the other one says it and means it as well, then you won't fight. No, neither one of the two sides will fight.
But you know, it relates to the fact that Trump just said a few days ago that he wants to rearm the U.S. with nukes or something in that sense. And so maybe he is also into games theory and practices it. As a businessman,
I don't know whether there is a direct nuclear threat on the United States. Well, I don't know.
Okay.
But no comment on that. I haven't read that. No comment.
I do want to go back for a second because I mean, you said the Cold War stayed cold and it never got hot because of this
because
this
of nuclear
mutual
weapons.
Threat. Yeah, this yes. deterrent. But I mean, some would say that it didn't remain cold. You know, I mean, you had the war in Vietnam. The United States joined in the mid-60s and it started already in the... So you could say, I mean, there's a different way of looking at it that maybe that these two great superpowers were building up strength and they had to release it or something in valves. I don't know, but what I'm saying is, you know, that period in time wasn't purely cold. I mean...
No, I mean, there were a lot of wars and you're right that the Vietnam War was especially painful. But I don't think the Russians were not directing that. It was the indigenous people over there in Vietnam. And talking about Vietnam, I visited Vietnam in 06, I think, or maybe 07.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is a communist country. They have a red flag with yellow trimmings and entirely communist. And it still is a communist country in the sense that it's politically, it's a dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
But in the, I think it was in the fall of 85, or late summer of 85, they suddenly decided to go from... from
communism,
from socialism, yes, mm-hmm. Socialism. In other words, joint ownership of all the production, the means of production, government ownership, and so on, and
they moved
and
from
to
that
to each according to his
yeah
needs, from each according to his ability. That philosophy was mm-hmm. never totally carried out, mm-hmm. but. From that philosophy, they moved to a market economy in August of 85, I think.
A bit like China.
China did it in 79, yes. Yeah.
How do you explain that?
And because they realized, the people in Vietnam, the government realized that their people were starving, okay? you want to sum up game theory in one word, it's incentives. Now, if you have from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs, there's no incentive to work. You're going to get whatever you need, yeah. Right? And the people who have ability are going to get their work taken away from them. It's a beautiful philosophy. It's lovely. It's something that I absolutely subscribe to. Mm-hmm. To each according to his needs, from each according to his ability. It's beautiful. There's one thing wrong with it. It doesn't work. Yes. But that's the only thing wrong with it. Yes.
Yeah.
So maybe we should subscribe to it. Anyway, a large part of the 20th century was devoted to this failed experiment of socialism. Mm-hmm. And
many lives were lost
and many people starved. And as I said, the government of Vietnam saw that their people were starving. And when we came in 06, it was a thriving country. Mm-hmm. It hasn't quite reached the levels of China yet, or it had not at that time, maybe in the meantime. A lot of people on bicycles and on motorcycles. You saw a whole family on bicycle. Yeah, 6 or 7 people on one bicycle.
Yeah, that's also sharing.
What's that?
It's also sharing.
Yeah, but it's within the family.
So is it hard to, I mean, because it seems to me like it's tackling this, and I said abstract before because, I mean, I meant the opposite, actually, concrete, but abstract in mathematical terms. It seems difficult to me to tackle these world phenomenons with this purely mathematical approach when there's so many variables and there's all these. Do you not find that to be a struggle?
If it is math at all, is it more math or more philosophy?
No, we do math. But we learn things from the math, okay? We learn some of the more intricate implications of, for example, right now, just now, the government has passed a law saying that people who hold more than 2 apartments here in Israel have to pay a very heavy tax on them, okay? Now, it sounds great, okay, hit the rich and so on. If you hold more than 2 apartments here, you must be very, very rich. So hit them with a tax. But then you work out the implications of this. There are 2 implications. First of all, much fewer apartments will be available for rental. And second of all, the rents, when they are available, will shoot up. Yes.
Yep. Why so, not? It's my apartment.
Why not? I don't know. You're a nice Jewish boys, but a lot of the apartments in Jerusalem are rented to students, okay?
Yeah.
Who cannot very well afford.
But I mean, from the owner's perspective, he says, well, the government.
Yeah. You pass on.
I pass it on.
Yeah. So things are not always as they appear. And the implications, they come out from doing the math. But then you have to make sense out of them, okay? You have to make sense out of them without the math. And the math is often much more intricate than real life, okay? But, you know, if you want to, you really have to, if you want to go into something, you really have to understand it. You have to understand it on a much deeper level than the level in which you're going to use it. Because if you only understand it on the level in which you're going to use it, then a lot of things are going to be you're going to overlook a lot of things. You have to understand the whole structure, and that involves the math. But then you apply a few insights from it, and unusual insights, yeah.
So there is philosophy inside. It's both. It's philosophy and math.
I would say it's applied math, but I don't know. Call it philosophy if you wish. The insights that you learn from the mathematical analysis you apply to the real world, and they work.
So, may I, Eitan? Mm-hmm. Before we go along on our ways. what keeps you busy today? I mean, what's the big problem that, that bothers you that you're trying to solve? What are you working on nowadays? If there are still mysteries in that field.
Or if you can't tell us.
I'm working on a paper which... have you heard of behavioral economics?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm working on a paper which suggests a synthesis of behavioral and mainstream economics. That's one thing I'm working on. A few other things.
Okay.
Right now, yes. That's my main research concern. Okay.
Uh-huh. Behavioral.
A synthesis of, you know, behavioral economics really basically says people do not behave rationally. They do not promote their own interests. They do irrational things in the sense of not promoting their own interests. And mainstream economics says that people do behave rationally, okay?
Yeah.
And in fact, the Nobel Prize in 2002 was awarded to Vernon Smith and Danny Kahneman.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that.
And Kahneman got the prize for showing that people do not behave rationally. And Vern Smith got the prize for showing that people do behave rationally. So I developed this theme, and
You disagree with Kahneman, I read.
What's that?
You disagree with Kahneman's ideas, I read.
No. I don't disagree with Kahneman. I don't disagree with Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And the synthesis I suggest is that for things that happen, usually your evolution and learning and the people get used to the world. So for things that happen, usually people do behave rationally. They advance mm-hmm. their interests. And for things that are really unusual and unexpected, people do behave irrationally in a systematic way. So those are really the, when you look at it deeper, Kahneman and Smith do not disagree, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Kahneman's work applies to the unusual situation, the unexpected situation, the infrequent situation, whatever you want to call it.
Yes.
And so the exception to the rule, okay? And Smith applies to the rule, okay, to what happens frequently, usually, expectedly, as a rule.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So I think we have a little situation to analyze here, because who's going to win here in this game of ours? You want to leave. You want to get us out and go eat a donut. And we want to stay here.
I don't want to eat a donut, but I have to light candles at 4 o'clock.
Yeah. Okay.
Because I'm going at 4:30. I'm going to Debbie Lipstadt's
screening
movie. Mm-hmm. And we have to be there by 4:30. So I have to scoot out home. And
so you won in this game.
I promised my wife I'll be there at 3:30. That's not going to happen.
Okay.
But
we don't want to get in trouble with your wife.
Professor, thank you so much. It was delightful.
It was a pleasure.
And
thank you.
And best of luck and health and everything to you and your family. And Eitan, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. nice Jewish.
Bye-bye. Bye.